You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, April 21st, 2016. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live, not steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal, but from the bowels of the Wynn Hotel in Las Vegas, Nevada, where I am once again covering the Masked Torts Conference in Las Vegas, Nevada. On the program today, lawyers, maybe some other guests, but it's going to be primarily lawyers, ladies and gentlemen. And regular listeners of the program will know that I make this trip twice a year or so. Family allowing. And the conference is in part sponsored by Levin Papantonio, Mike Papantonio, my often co-host on Ring of Fire Radio. And it is a collection of trial attorneys from across the country. And then there's other people, but primarily trial attorneys who are working on a wide range of cases that can deal with wage theft, all forms of employment, issues regarding LGBT rights, also huge product liability cases. I spoke to someone, and I think I'm going to play this. I've done a bunch of interviews that I've already pre-taped, and I'm going to play a couple, at least one or two today, from yesterday when I was taping. But stories of product liability, stories of environmental destruction by corporations, and I mean, the list goes on. Issues of arbitration. It's fascinating. Essentially, what trial lawyers function as is the sort of old-fashioned deputized posses. In many instances, depending on the size of the case, they will team up with prosecutors, attorney generals, state, district, city, and they will sometimes litigate these cases with them. Sometimes they will provide sort of the backroom research for these cases. The second interview I think I'm going to run today is a QI-TAM case, which is basically, I don't know what it means exactly, actually, now that I think about it, but it is QI-TAM cases are ones where there is a whistleblower, particularly in the context of Medicare or Medicaid fraud. And we hear a lot about fraud and abuse and waste. And the myth, of course, is that this fraud and abuse is from the people who use Medicare or Medicaid, for that matter. And it's absolutely not the case. It's the opposite. It is corporations, businesses that are defrauding the government. We're going to hear a lot about fraud and abuse, I have a feeling, in the next couple of months, because that seems to be the only thing that Donald Trump can talk about in terms of a policy apparatus. And but it's, and you know, Governor Rick Scott of Florida was one of those guys who was perpetrating fraud. Let me rephrase that. Who pled the fifth, I don't know how many times, a couple of dozen times, in the investigation into the fraud that his company that he was the CEO of committed, to the tune of, I don't know what the settlement was, in the billions, I think. Just to give you a sense of the scale of that fraud. But these trial lawyers, it's an interesting bunch of people here. In the past, at this event, I've interviewed Rosa Parks' attorney, ranging from people who sat on the committee to develop the payment system for the fallout from the BP spill. I think we're going to get an update on the C8 cases, which is DuPont's basically poisoning of the environment. And when we were here in October, the first case had just, the first of 3,500 cases had just been tried. And we'll recap that later. But ladies and gentlemen, as you know, I am in Las Vegas for a conference. And I have to say that probably this conference represents the most put together I am for 2 or 3 days in a row at any other time during the year, perhaps at any other time in my life. I wear a sports jacket. I wear an ironed shirt. And I am clean shaven every single day I am here. So I'm trying to project an air of professionalism, which in my real life, I don't have. But because I'm not just a dispossessed voice, I'm actually, this place is teeming with people. I have to look like a normal person, you know, like an adult. I mean, I'm at that age, let's face it. And so when I come to Las Vegas, I always bring my Harry's razor, and it gets probably its biggest workout that it does at any other time of the year, because I shave every day and I never do that. But I gotta say, I mean, it's tough to me to compare, because I don't know that I did that prior to starting to use Harry's razors. But the razors are great. They're German engineered, 5-blade cartridges, close, comfortable shave, quality guaranteed, full refund if you're not happy. And here's the thing, folks. They cut out the middleman. They ship it right to your door. They sell their blades at half the price of the leading brand. No more big, you know, what are they, like ice shacks, those plexiglass containers. You go to harrys.com, find out what you need, check out in 30 seconds. And here's the deal. Their starter set, called the Truman, is just $15. You get a razor handle, moisturizing shave cream, 3 of Harry's 5-blade German-engineered razors. Plus, there's a special offer for fans of the show. Folks, this is like the functional equivalent of going to Vegas and putting a chip down on the roulette wheel and then it paying off. Because Harry's will give you $5 off your first purchase when you visit harrys.com and use the promo code MajorityReport. That's promo code MajorityReport right now to redeem your offer. first off, today, what I want to play is actually an interview I did, I think, from last October. And I did not end up playing it anywhere. It's still relevant. It deals with the idea of tort reform. And so I think there's a little bit of a header on this by me. And then you'll hear from John Fitch, who is an attorney who apparently... Do I have this right? I'm asking. John Fitch was briefly mentioned in the, what was it, in Spotlight, that movie? Was he one of the, no? Oh, he had worked on that case. Okay, well, you'll hear this. It's a little bit disturbing. It's one of those unintended consequences of tort reform. Or maybe intended. I don't know. But we're going to play this clip, and... it'll be a little bit short at the end, but bear with me because I'm on the road and don't always have my full faculties. So here is that interview I did last year, or last October, here at this Mass Torts Conference. We'll be back in just a moment. John Fitch. He is from the Fitch Law Firm. You find it at thefitchlawfirm.com in Columbus, Ohio. And we've spoken many times on this program about the fallacy and the sort of the, I guess, the intent behind so-called tort reform law. And in addition to it functioning to serve to prevent people from having their day in court, because tort reform comes in many forms, but at the end of the day, it's all designed to prevent individuals from having the opportunity for recourse against corporations. Corporations have all the advantages in a system, an adversarial system like ours. They have the resources, they have the manpower, they have the lobbying to basically outlast the individual, and which is why, really, litigators in this country are so relevant and must be so, frankly, so funded. But, John, you have a story coming out of Columbus about tort reform and its sort of unintended consequences, I guess, even from the perspective, I would imagine, of corporations. Tell us about the case that you are working on.
I'm happy to tell you about the case, although I must respectfully disagree with your comment or your view that this is unintended, because in fact, after my case received some publicity, there was an effort in the Ohio legislature to correct what is clearly a major injustice, and that bill went nowhere. So here's the case. My client is 15 years old. She is raped by her pastor at a church during a counseling session. She's actually raped twice by him in his office. We did an extensive investigation, including tracking down a young woman who was in her late 30s at the time in Italy, who many years ago had complained to the church about this particular pastor. Essentially, he tried to stick his hand down her pants, and she was 14, 15 years old at the time. And she and her mother confronted the church, and the head of the church said, according to the mother, who was present for trial, "Let's keep this quiet to protect our brother." We had another woman who was 18 at the time, but during a counseling session, this particular pastor said some incredibly vile things that were obviously sexual in nature, that were very disturbing to her. She also reported to the church, and nothing happened. And then several years later, my client is raped. The case went to trial. My client was awarded $3.5 million for her pain and suffering. had tremendous problems with post-traumatic stress disorder.
And let me just ask you, who is the defendant in this situation?
The defendant in the case is the church.
And were there criminal prosecutions pursued against the pastor?
There were. The pastor was given, he was charged with rape, but he pled to a lesser charge that still got him 8 years in prison. So he's still in prison at the time.
So the question is how could the church, with the alleged aforementioned knowledge of what who this guy was, allow him to continue to work and to have not reported, I guess, these instances earlier? Is that...
Not only not reported, didn't even take it to the elder board, the governing board of the church, apparently because of the fear of embarrassment or whatever ramifications. We're not sure what their rationale was, but it didn't happen. And so they allowed him to continue, and then eventually funded him in a new church setting of his own.
Jeez.
And that's where this incident occurred. So in any event, under tort reform in Ohio, a child can be raped multiple times, as my client was, and be subject to one cap. In this case, it's going to be $250,000 based upon the record we have. There's a complex formula where you can get up to $350,000. We didn't get there. So the award is reduced by more than 90%. But it's really worse than that. We argue that because there are two incidents, he pled guilty to two incidents, there should be two caps. So it should be $500,000. The trial court, very good judge, reading the law, said no, under tort reform you get $250,000. But it's even worse in the sense that we've been at this for 8 years. We have tens of thousands of dollars in expenses, which must come out of the $250,000. And, of course, she has litigation or attorney fees in addition to the litigation expenses. So the question becomes, why are we protecting the most... why are we limiting the rights of children who suffer the most vile and degrading acts that a human being can suffer, on the one hand, and on the other, protecting those who are responsible for it, whether it's the actual perpetrator himself or those who would actively conceal, and they did conceal, you know, this kind of hideous conduct? I mean, as a matter of public policy, that is what the state of Ohio is now doing, and we're challenging the constitutionality of the statute, you know, in the Ohio Supreme Court, and that's where we are now.
So just mechanically, what happens is the jury comes back with an award, but the trial lawyer the trial judge says, unfortunately, under Ohio State Court, I have to cut it off at $250,000, Ohio State law, I have to cut it off at $250,000 once the jury award exceeds that.
Yes. Yes, and the jury's never told about caps. So it's a secret to them. They think that, you know, they're...
So how has it failed? And so there was a proposal in the legislature to simply amend it in this very narrow...
Exactly. Sexually abused people. You know, the case garnered some publicity locally. There was a Democratic... representative out of Cincinnati. Her name is Connie Pillich. My understanding of the bill was that the co-sponsors were all Democrats. In Ohio, the
Republican
legislature is controlled by the Republicans. The bill got one hearing and died. So even in the face of such an incredible miscarriage of justice, in my view, the response was to do nothing. They're good with the law that they have.
I got to think that from their perspective, it is tort reform is so important to us that we're willing to establish this principle and this notion of a cap, even if it means denying some form of justice and, frankly, accountability for an institution that at the very least concealed, and I would argue in its concealment, enabled this guy to...
Yeah, I mean, without question, that you know, that's the question for the jury. I mean, they argued causation. They argued, well, he didn't rape anybody else. You know, these other incidents were, you know, a number of years ago, but the jury came back and says, yes, this man's conduct caused her injuries. But the bottom line is that the power and the money and the influence of the insurance industry and big business, who through their, what is called the Civil Association of Justice, or I don't even remember, civil trial attorneys, it's the insurance industry's legal group. They file a brief and they say, no, we're good with this.
Because it's ultimately the insurance companies who are going to pay.
Believe that this should be constitutional. It is constitutional, and they're fine with outcomes of this nature. So it's the money and the power of and influence, you know, within the legislature. I mean, obviously, if children like my clients had any, in my view, had any degree of political influence, the power to move things, we think that, you know, maybe things would be different, but they don't, certainly as compared to the insurance industry.
John Fitch from the Fitch Law Firm. You can find more information at thefitchlawfirm.com. I guess, you know, all I can say is if you live in Ohio, folks, write your state legislatures. I mean, I don't know how it's sort of stunning, the power of the insurance companies when it comes to limiting accountability for even in this most heinous of crime.
Okay, folks, that was an interview I did with John Fitch months ago, and I'm looking for him to see if he's here this at this conference to get an update. But it just gives you a sense of, in addition, I would imagine, to outrage, a sense of the range of cases and the implications of these cases. I mean, one of the things that becomes clear to me as I return to this conference year after year is the how these attorneys professionally just sort of walk around, or I should say sort of walk through this universe where they know the worst things about people. I'm starting to, you know, sort of realize the how much of a part of it that is of their world outlook. They will go through the discovery process, which is the process prior to a trial. And often, even after going through discovery, it will not go to trial. There will be, very often, I should say, there is a settlement at that point, because it's a game the corporation is playing. We're going to dump on you a million documents and presume that you don't have the resources to find anything that would be problematic for us. And very often the attorneys find something, or sometimes they find something, I guess. And it's really disturbing stuff. To tease this. But I spoke to an attorney yesterday, and I think I'll probably play that interview tomorrow or maybe sometime in the future, who did some work on a case involving Remington, the rifle maker, not related to the case that's pending in Connecticut right now from Sandy Hook. But apparently the Remington rifle had a defect that would cause it to fire without the trigger being pulled. And it was through discovery that this attorney found out that Remington had been aware of this defect for 30 years. Not clear how many lives were lost because of it, but certainly, at the very least, one that this attorney knew of and had represented. But just to give you a sense of what these lawyers come across, next up, I'm going to play an interview from Arthur Scherr. He is a lawyer who pursues QI-TAM cases. And these are basically government whistleblowers, or whistleblowers, I should say. They're fraud cases, essentially, where fraud is committed against a federal government or a state government. And a QI-TAM lawsuit is brought by a whistleblower who brings the lawsuit on behalf of the government. And you'll hear from this attorney, and this is part of the interview I did with him, that the government just doesn't have the resources that I think sometimes we assume it does. In other words, the government is not, in the same way that you send your taxes in, and there is essentially the government is saying, like, we trust you. We trust that you're paying what you should be paying in terms of taxes. And we randomly audit people as a way of enforcement because we don't have the ability to actually audit every tax form that comes in. It's the same thing with Medicare claims. And these Medicare claims are not claims that are issued by an individual. They are billed by hospitals, by doctors' groups, by medical device makers. And Medicare presumes that they're getting billed for something that is not fraudulent. And it is basically these whistleblowers and then the trial attorneys who provide much of the enforcement mechanism. And you should know that what happens is QI-TAM whistleblowers get treble the damages if it goes to court. So if it's a $100 million fraud in this case, the whistleblower could get up to $300 million from the fraudster. But listen to this story from Arthur Scherr. I think you'll find it fascinating. And it's really telling and really important to keep in mind when you hear people like Donald Trump and whatnot going up during the debates and whatnot, talking about waste, abuse, and fraud, because there's always this sense that, oh, it's government waste. It's government abuse and fraud. No, it is just like normal fraud and abuse and waste. It's in the private sector, and it's perpetrated against government. And when it's done against government, understand, it's our dollars they're stealing. All right, let's go to that interview now. Forgive me for no musical interludes here, ladies and gentlemen. Joining me now is David Scherr. He's a principal at the Employment Law Group in Washington, D.C. David, welcome to the program.
Hello, thank you.
So tell us about Joseph Ting.
Dr. Ting is a medical physicist. He was practicing as a medical physicist for, I think, 30, 40 years or something. He's in his late 60s. And do you want me to tell you a little bit about the case? Or?
Please.
Yeah, okay. Well, Dr. Ting has been really an expert in his field. And if you don't know what medical physics is, basically they are the people when you have a cancer treatment, an oncology treatment, any kind of radiation, they take the measurements, they line people up, they organize things in order to make sure that the patient is properly placed on the scanner. and that the treatment is administered properly. And they work directly with the doctors to do that. In this particular case, Dr. Ting was working for a company called South Florida Radiation Oncology, or SFRO. SFRO. SFRO was doing things basically correctly. And there was, after a period of time, they were acquired by this company called 21st Century Oncology. Mm-hmm. 21st Century is perhaps the largest oncology provider in the country. In fact, they are the largest oncology provider in the world. They have operations in Costa Rica and a number of foreign countries. And their business model, as best I can tell, is to basically swallow up the industry. They were going around buying.
And now is this an American company?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Okay.
Well, they're an American company, but a couple of the executives are from Panama or Costa Rica. I'm not sure exactly where, but they're from a foreign country. But the company itself is an American-based company. When you look at their org chart, it's pages long.
Huge.
You know, it's huge. What happened is that they became systematized. 21st Century basically, from the top down, drove the level of care, how the care would be administered, how billing would be done, and in fact, what machines would be used. And that's really the problem that Dr. Ting encountered. It's this idea that machines took over the medicine practice. His case focused around this technology called gamma. Mm. Gamma is basically a little dose of radiation administered to the patient. It was a technique developed by the CFO or the CTO, who was really a tech guy. And he came up with this way of administering this dose to every patient who came in for oncology treatment, every time they came in every field or port. A port is like a little dot on your body. Okay. The actual administering of the test is not bad. It doesn't hurt the patient, other than it keeps the patient on the table for an extra 15, 20 minutes. Now, I do have to say, if I'm in there for a cancer treatment, the last thing I want to do is on the table an extra 20 minutes. I'm already coming in for radiation. But other than that.
All right. So just so I'm clear, they have come up with this system that treats each patient sort of generically.
Yes. Well, more importantly, it doesn't treat anything. It basically takes a dosage of the patient, in theory, to engage in some additional quality control measure. Now, there's already 7 or 8 quality control measures. The patient's oriented correctly. The doctor's looking. The medical physicist is looking. Their x-ray is done. And Dr. Ting's concern was that gamma did nothing. And, in fact, our contention is it actually does nothing. It doesn't do anything. It doesn't serve any purpose. And Dr. Ting's concern was that if they want to do gamma, fine, do gamma. But don't bill the government for it because it doesn't accomplish anything. And there's not even a billing code that applies to it.
And so from the perspective of 21st Century Oncology, what did ostensibly gamma do? I mean, they're saying it's quality control.
Yes.
But what exactly did it? I mean, is that it? It's just a way of making
That's
sure
it.
That.
I mean, graphically, what it does is it took 2 pictures of a patient in different points in time. It would take 2 pictures of a patient at different points in time. So there's actually a picture from a presentation I saw where they took 2 pictures of a tiger and they showed them at different stages and they put them together to show that we're taking 2 pictures of this patient at different points of time just to make sure they're lining up the same. Okay. However, this was useless for a number of reasons.
So this isn't like we're establishing a baseline, you come back 6 to 8 months later,
right,
and we're seeing if there's any type of development. That's not what's going on here.
That's already done through several other procedures. The patient is already baseline when they come in the door. So there's no reason to baseline them again. What they were in theory doing was we're going to keep baselining the patient every time the patient comes in. But that was unnecessary because several other procedures were already implemented doing the same thing. In addition to that, there were a number of things that explained these changes that had nothing to do with radiation treatment. The patient didn't go to the bathroom. The patient was, you know, dehydrated that day. These things are all tested through other objective measures. The science that was in these PowerPoint presentations was shown to be not effective. It didn't actually, in fact, 21st Century's own science, own PowerPoints, own presentations and white papers demonstrated a barely marginal change in patient care as a result of implementing gamma. And Dr. Ting contends that that was really, those numbers were really.
Just a little static.
Static in the air. It could have gone the other way just as
right,
easily,
okay.
Basically. The main problem Dr. Ting had is that doctors didn't have a choice about implementing gamma. And the main problem that 21st Century ran into is that to implement a procedure like this, it must be doctor approved, at least if you're going to bill it to Medicare. So, you know, you have taxpayer dollars going out to a company. Medicare wants to know that a doctor has approved it, at least for this type of a procedure. Doctors didn't have discretion. The computer system was set up that gamma was already automatically done. Gamma was – there was a mandates in email communications that basically said you will implement gamma on every patient, every field, every time, period, which of course removes any medical discretion.
Right.
So now doctors didn't even know what it was. I mean, if you talk to the doctors, they didn't know what it was. They didn't even know what it did, and they didn't care. They would just went about their business.
Right.
You know?
As long as it doesn't hurt my patient,
right.
And it's not coming out of my pocket.
Right.
It doesn't matter.
That's
right.
Right. That's right. And Dr. Ting, he was interviewed for AARP magazine recently, and what he said about it is they asked him, didn't you guys all talk about this? And he said, yes, we all talked about it. We all knew it was useless, but no one wanted to complain because everyone was too afraid. They just figure we'll just let this test run, and we'll throw it in the garbage, and that's that.
Does a guy like Dr. Ting, as he's, you know, they're sitting around going like the, you know, in the commissary,
yes.
Essentially saying,
yeah.
This is a waste of time.
Right.
But it's not like, it's not costing us because it's not that much of a waste of time. In other words, are we seeing less patients a day because of it, or are we servicing less patients a day because of it at the end of the day? Are they also aware at that point, like, but this is padding somebody's pocket.
Right. That's Dr. Ting started having that concern when he got a text from somebody in another facility in another state saying, who knew Dr. Ting from a prior job, saying, did you know they're billing Medicare for this? And that's when Dr. Ting got upset. It wasn't because he cared about people's pockets being lined or the procedure itself. What he was concerned about was his own kids. He said, I am really committed to Medicare. I use it, and I want it to be around for generations to come. And this is the kind of stuff that is going to devastate the Medicare system.
Right.
And he's right, by the way, just incidentally, about a third of our Medicare system is fraud. And that's bad. Medicare is necessary, okay? The two-thirds that is, you know, used correctly and used by senior citizens and others in a correct way, without that, our society would fall apart.
A third is fraud?
Yes.
I mean, I want to obviously come back to Dr. Tang's story, but, I mean, characterize the nature of that fraud.
Okay.
Because, I mean, that's an extraordinary amount. And we
yes.
should say that Medicare is, you know, when we hear all these conversations about, you know, entitlement reform and whatnot,
right.
Social Security basically pays you back what you paid in, more or less.
More or less, yeah.
But Medicare pays out a lot more
right.
than what is brought in, and that's why it's in such a precarious state.
Exactly.
And so if one-third of it, so give us a sense of what the characterize the nature of the fraud.
Like the types of fraud that
yeah.
are occurring? The biggest one is elder abuse in nursing homes and hospice. For example, keeping people in hospice for 2 years, 3 years. I have about a dozen cases around the country filed right now because they'll put people into hospice for Alzheimer's. Well, Alzheimer's is not a hospice condition. Hospice is for people who are going to die soon, certainly within the next few weeks, at most 6 months. And we have cases where there are hundreds of patients who have been, quote, unquote, in hospice for 2 years.
Wow.
Which is, of course, ridiculous. They're not in hospice. They're just being billed as if they're in hospice. Home health care and nursing home fraud. The biggest area of that, and we have a case now, it's a huge case against basically a network of nursing homes. And, you know, this is like the too big to fail problem. If they go in and do something about it, the whole system's going to fall apart in this particular state because there are so many of them. But it's basically bribing doctors to refer patients, whether they need to be in a nursing home or not. When I say bribe, I mean paying them money, giving them cars. We even have examples of marketing people being told to have sex with doctors in order to refer them. And that, aside from being illegal, maybe in every state except perhaps the one we're in now in Vegas,
right.
Is also a kickback. All right. But while the patients are there, we have another case in which the Medicare pays nursing homes a fixed amount of money to do a range of services, $100 a patient per day. They're supposed to, you know, diaper them if necessary, feed them if necessary, provide correct medication and therapy, and make sure they have a safe place to stay. In the example I'm just describing now, it's a different case in another state. The patients are crapping on the floor. They're not being provided food. They're being underfed. They're malnourished. They're being over-medicated and drugged to the wazoo in order to keep them from complaining. And their housing conditions are terrible. And CMS has actually dinged them on 15 different occasions for all kinds of different problems, but they're still open, right? So it takes somebody like a whistleblower to go, this isn't just, you know, because you only see what you see when you walk in the door to audit, right? This is a problem, a systemic problem throughout this entire enterprise. It's costing the government hundreds of millions of dollars. And by the way, these patients are being abused. Those are the two main ones. The third biggest one is off-label marketing of drugs.
Right.
So in the pharmaceutical industry. We can talk more about that.
I'd like to. But I want to get back to Dr.
Sure.
Ting's. So Dr. Ting realizes that these practices, which have up to this point just been an office joke, like,
right,
here we got to go again and waste some time, but realizes now this is – I mean, is he conscious at that point of that this is really sort of – that may be the motivation behind Gamma?
Right. That's,
I mean,
his,
is it?
He, well, his concern is if everyone knows, all the medical physicists are saying this is useless. He then talks to the doctors. They don't even know what it is. He's saying to himself, this doesn't do anything. Why are we doing it? And when he finds out that Medicare is being billed, he knows. And then he has a meeting. He sends several emails and has a meeting with a senior executive in the company. The executive first says, no, we don't bill Medicare. And then says, well, we do bill Medicare. We kind of bill Medicare. It goes back and forth, right? And then Dr. Ting does his own work into talks to various people in billing and finds out, in fact, they do bill Medicare, a code that really doesn't apply, to the tune of over $100 million.
Wow. And so they're using a code that might be associated with...
It's a code used for the administration of radiation for a quality purpose, but this particular procedure did not meet that code's requirements. There are six different requirements. It didn't meet any of them.
And so at what point does Dr. Ting, I mean, he makes a decision at one point, right? Is that to contact you or?
He protests internally. He tries to get it fixed, nothing happens. Now, Dr. Ting is one of those people who's very secure. He didn't care if they fired him or not because he'd get another job anywhere the next day. He's an expert in his field. But he didn't actually quit. He called us and he said, I don't know what to do. I know this is a bad procedure that's costing Medicare. I want it to stop. And so we filed the case on his behalf in Jacksonville.
And what is the status of the case now?
It's settled. So after we had an excellent the U.S. Attorney's Office in Jacksonville, Florida is really just fantastic. They investigate cases thoroughly. They intrude quickly. They do the investigation they need to do, and they take steps to rectify the problem. They discovered that the 21st Century had billed well over $100 million to Medicare.
Wow.
Medicare itself, now, you know, Medicare works like your IRS tax filing. You file it, you get paid. It's only if Medicare comes back down the road to look at it that anything happens. They're not looking at every claim as it's filed. It's
right.
Impossible to do that.
So they're not auditing every claim. They're
right.
Just someone literally needs to
right.
Blow the whistle or raise a red flag.
Exactly. So when Dr. Ting blew the whistle, Medicare suddenly looks at this and goes, wait a minute, you know, there's something wrong with this. Now, of course, the company should have paid $100 million times three because it's treble damages under the statute. But then 21st Century would cease to exist, and all of the enterprises that are doing – I mean, some of the work they're doing is good
right. –
would disappear.
Right.
So through negotiations, 21st Century agreed to pay $35 million. And that's a lot. But it's not everything. And they also agreed to stop doing it or to stop doing it the way they were doing it.
So as an attorney now, are you out there looking for these? Are you actively now looking for these cases? I mean, is this a new type of fraud that you – I mean, because this is – I mean, I imagine they're not necessarily charging that much, right, for the Gamma. But if they're doing it for every one of their patients.
Right.
And they've got it down now where it costs them virtually nothing to perform this activity.
Right.
You know, this is like, this is the functional equivalent of AT&T in Concepcion, I guess, on some level, right?
Yeah.
3 cents on everybody's bill. Who's going to notice?
That's right.
Are you out there now actively looking, or how do you go about looking to see if there's more of that out there or if you can find a client?
Okay. I, if I can take a few minutes, there's a couple of different answers to your question. So the real problem here is medical non-necessity, doing things that aren't necessary. That's happening in home health care, in hospice, in physical therapy, where patients are either receiving services they don't need or being billed for services that aren't actually being performed, but they pretend that they are. Okay.
Right.
This is an example of medical services being performed that are useless. The difference is the logarithmic leap. You know, yeah, you're right. It's $100 a unit. But if you're doing it six times on every patient every day, that's $6,000 a day per per patient. That's where the numbers start to climb. We are looking for that sort of thing. But the way we do our work is we put ourselves out there and we let people call us. So you know, you can go to our website. You have social media, you know, like that. People find us that way. So I don't go out and look for cases like this, but I can tell you that when somebody calls us and says, there's a procedure being done that is useless, we're very interested in that.
All right. And just getting also into the sort of the fraud thing, just so that we're clear on this, that, you know, we're talking about Medicare fraud.
Yes.
So much of the conversation turns out to be how much of the Medicare fraud, as someone who does this for a living, how much Medicare and Medicaid fraud do you come across that is really a function of the patients in some way? Defrauding the system?
Very little. You know, used to everyone just think, oh, patients are just abusing the system. That happens. Patients are getting drugs they don't need, or just because it's free, they get it. Of course that happens. But we're looking at hundreds of billions of dollars, and maybe a few million dollars of that is patients abusing the system. Billions and billions of dollars of it is drug companies selling medication that's supposed to be used for severe pain for somebody who's about to die, and doctors are being kicked back in order to go sell it for headaches or knee pain and stuff like that. People are dying on the streets because they're abusing these medications.
Right.
These are patients who don't know that these medications are going to kill them.
Right.
You know, things like that. And the companies consider it a cost of doing business. So a drug company, let's just take this example. 21st Century made $100 million but paid $35 million back. So if I told you that you could steal $100 million and you'd only have to pay $35 back, putting aside your ethics for a moment, of course you'd do that.
Right. I mean, that's actually just a business plan.
Yes. And big pharma companies, you know, the Department of Justice, to its credit, will go in and settle $1 billion. They'll collect $1 billion from AstraZeneca for off-label marketing a drug or selling a drug that's supposed to be for prostate cancer but is being sold for headaches, okay, whatever it is. But AstraZeneca made $3 billion on the drug. So, yes, it's great that money came back to taxpayers. That's fabulous. But AstraZeneca, and I don't mean to point them out, but drug companies and nursing homes and hospice centers just view this as, well, we may get caught one day, and if we do, we're only going to have to pay some of it back. So, you know, let's do it. That doesn't mean, by the way, that everyone's doing it. You know, my brother works in this industry,
right,
and his company is clean as a whistle. So there are organizations that are trying to do things right.
All right, folks, that was David Scher. I think I said Arthur at the beginning, so my apologies for that. But that was David Scher. I have a little bit more of that interview, but maybe we'll play the rest of it another day. But another example of the types of things that trial lawyers are doing on our behalf. Also, folks, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate this month only, which means 7 more days, 8 more days, 9 more days, however many days are left in April. 30% off of coffee, 30%. That's almost exactly one third. Use the coupon code MRSPRING16 and get 30% off your coffee. You've always wanted to try the Majority Report blend. Your friends are all drinking it. They're looking at you strange, sort of sideways. And you've never known why they keep looking at you that way. It's because you're not drinking the Majority Report blend from Just Coffee. And now you have a chance to do it with 30% off.
All right, coming up, I think we're going to head into the fun half. I'm going to try and take some IMs. I'm going to try and take some calls. And we may have, my understanding is that Representative Alan Grayson is in the locale. I think he used to be a trial lawyer, Grayson.
He is still.
He still is. So
whistleblower cases.
Whistleblower key TAM cases? So hopefully if we can land him, if it happens in the fun half of the show, we'll try and present it. I don't know, we'll put it out maybe as some bonus material for free beers. I mean, the bottom line is that's what happens when you become a member. You get the good stuff. And you get it. Oh, my God, that guy's got a drone. What the frick? There's a guy with a drone. I don't know what he's doing right now. I don't think it would be appropriate to fly that thing around in here. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920 is the number. You can try and IM me, but I cannot figure out a good IM system for an iPad. Oh, is that Tom Hartman? Oh, wait a second. You got to bring Hartman over here. See if we can get him on. This is what it's like, ladies and gentlemen. This is the type of life I lead. If I could just get you Tom Hartman. Oh, look at this. Look at this. What luck, ladies and gentlemen. Now, if I had any of this luck at the table, yes, please. If I had any of this luck at the table, you'd probably never hear from me again. I would just take off and I would be. But just as I was about to go into the fun half of the program, the show gets considerably more fun. Tom Hartman is joining us. Hello, Tom.
Hello, Sam. How are you?
I'm doing great.
It's great to be here with you.
It's great to see you. We run into each other here every so often.
Yeah.
You give me advice on blackjack that it takes me a year to recover from.
My apologies.
And
every system is doomed, including mine.
And, you know, I wanted to talk to you about it because I've noticed they've changed the odds here.
Seriously?
At the Wynn Hotel. Yes.
To the benefit of the casino, presumably?
Yes, yes. Yeah. And
how do you change the odds in craps?
So I was playing
a
system, a very boring system, where I would just bet the pass line, and then I would back it up.
Right.
And you used to be able to back it up either 2 to 3 or 4 times, I think it was, or 3, 4, 5 times, based upon what was the point number. But now you can only double it or something like that.
Yeah, so by backing up, you mean like double your bet when you lose?
No, it means that I can just put a side bet on the pass line.
Okay, I don't know craps well enough to...
Frankly, I'm not sure I understand what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So, Tom, let's talk. This has been... It's been a while since we've talked.
Mm.
The number of people that I have run into over the past year who know of Bernie Sanders prior to his run because of hearing him on your show on Fridays.
For 10 years. Yeah.
More than 10 years because...
Yeah. His first... No. He was first on our show in February or March of 2004.
Yeah, that's 12 years.
That's 12 years. Yeah, well, he hasn't been on for the last 6 months, so 11 and a half.
I understand.
Yeah, okay.
I understand. He's been busy.
Yeah.
He's been busy.
And he still is. God bless him.
So, all right, give me your assessment. Let's just start with the fact that where he is now. I mean, mathematically, it's still conceivable he could win, but... Just in terms of what he's accomplished at this point, give me your sense of like how much has that exceeded or not surprised you from, let's say, Tom Hartman sitting here a year ago and we're contemplating Bernie running.
Yeah, I frankly did not expect the response to Bernie's candidacy to be as broad or as strong as it has been. But in retrospect, I should have, because... You know, the revolution is on. And the this is a point that I make in my book, The Crash of 2016, is that essentially the revolution began with the election of George W. Bush, or the selection of George W. Bush by the Supreme Court. And, you know, within a year and a half, we had over a million people on the streets in the U.S. protesting his desire to attack Iraq. And, I mean, you can go back to previous events before
WTO
that.
And say, in Seattle, yeah, WTO really, in Seattle, to me, seems to be the like a sort of
But it was not national. I mean, right. It didn't have the depth that Bernie has. It wasn't reaching down to high school kids. It wasn't reaching out to, you know, inflaming entire colleges on the East Coast, right, kind of thing. But yeah, it's been building, and people get it, that the system is rigged and the parties are rigged and that everything is all screwed up and that we've been robbed by the billionaires ever since Reaganomics set the whole thing up, changing the rules for executive compensation, dropping the top tax rate, stopping the enforcement of the Sherman Antitrust Act, granting endless waivers to government agencies to not buy American-made goods. The Buy America Act of 1935 requires the government to buy American manufactured goods, which is our government is like 18% of our economy,
right?
And unless there's a waiver from the executive branch, Reagan started giving them away like candy, and every president has since then. So federal agencies now are operating with computers made in China. You know, the IRS. It's like, and God only knows what's in the computers,
yeah,
or the EPROMs.
That to me seems a little bit.
It's all totally bizarre. So you know, people get it, and what Bernie has done is distill all that. You know, then you had Occupy, and you had Black Lives Matter, and then along came Bernie, and up until Bernie, there hadn't been a leader to that movement, or at least a clear leader. I mean, there were a number of people who emerged as highly visible, but the movement. And I would say, in part, where the CRP sort of took over the New York Occupy movement, and
the CRP,
yeah, the Communist Revolutionary Party. It's Bob Avakian's group, and they're into this absolute leaderless movement. And if anybody tries to be a leader, no, you can't do that. We are totally horizontal. Everybody has the same say, et cetera, et cetera. And you know, which is wonderful egalitarian idealism. But at a certain point, you actually do have to have somebody in a position to exercise power, and like Bernie Sanders could be as president. And so, you know, I think that that's what's going on. And if Bernie becomes the nominee, great, we'll have a next FDR. If Bernie's not the nominee, the revolution's not going to stop.
Right.
It's already well underway.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me that there's been, you can track the... You know, I think so much of it is we're no longer under the sort of the specter of the Soviet Union. And there's a lot of people now alive that, you know, have no memory of that.
Oh, yeah.
And so the same buzzwords don't carry the same sort of like resonance that they did. I've told this story a couple of times, but I was interviewed like I think probably around this time last year, maybe a little bit later, by a Politico reporter who wanted to get the progressive take. He was doing a piece on Martin O'Malley, and Martin O'Malley wanted to know, like, how can he sort of outshine Elizabeth Warren? And I'm like, well, Elizabeth Warren's not running.
Right.
He's got to wonder how he can outshine Bernie Sanders.
Right.
And the guy was so dismissive
of Bernie
and just the idea that he could do well, even in the Democratic Party. And I realized just sort of how blindsided all these people were going to be. Now, I don't know that I would have predicted that Bernie has done this because his trajectory is still going up.
Yes.
I mean, even if it's not, going to translate into a nomination, the trajectory in terms of people embracing these ideas, and I'll also say, I mean, I don't know what the numbers are on this, and I haven't seen any polling to this effect. But just anecdotally, in conversations that I've had and people I've seen and stories I've read, there's a tremendous amount of Hillary Clinton support that would very readily say, I like everything Bernie stands for, mm-hmm. But she's more pragmatic or whatnot, which I think is also fascinating. I mean, I have yet to see a poll that says, like, how many of... Because I don't think it goes the other way, frankly. I think that's extraordinary at this point. And yeah. Let me ask you this, because
I think it does go the other way, actually. I think that there are a lot of Bernie supporters who, if Hillary Clinton is the nominee, and this is the huge if she continues to move in a more progressive direction and leave behind the third way, the DLC ideology, neoliberalism, basically, who will enthusiastically support her.
I think that's true.
But that if is...
I think that's true, but just in the way that you conditioned that is my point.
Right.
Is that there are a lot more people who say, like, I like Bernie's proposals, but I am voting for Hillary because I think she's more pragmatic, or I think that she can win, or whatever it is. I don't think there's a lot of people saying, like, I like Hillary's issues, but I'm voting for Bernie because I find him more charismatic. I mean, that's just not what the allure is. And I mean, yes, I agree with you. I mean, I think the polling out of New York was pretty clear on that. I think there's a lot of the Bernie or bust stuff, I think, is sort of a function of we're standing close to that part of the elephant that
sure.
is that makes it look like that from the, you know, when I'm sitting here behind a microphone taking IMs from people and emails.
Yeah.
But my sense is, too, though, one of the things I think, you know, because when I started doing this, it was during the Bush administration, and having seen the
Same
difference.
Here.
Well, yes. And but having been able to sort of compare and contrast the difference between having a Democratic president and a Republican president, the Democratic president who, you know, for a long time in on many things I had real issues with.
Mm-hmm.
But the sphere of argument is different. I mean, there were people who, you know, I perceived as, we're on the same side during the Bush administration, when I realized, like, not really.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm not, it's not about the teams, but in terms of, like, sharing an issue set.
Right.
I mean, I just, I think out of convenience, say a guy like Jonathan Alter, mm-hmm. who, you know, I remember Jonathan Alter from 2004, and then I remember Jonathan Alter from 2009, telling me that, you know, Democrats are so chaste when it comes to Social Security.
Yeah.
Now, oddly enough, I just saw him come out with a story saying Hillary should take Bernie's college proposal, which is, I mean...
Hillary should take Bernie's every proposal.
Yes, I mean, but this is amazing.
I mean,
she
should become Bernie Sanders.
Ways.
You know,
yeah.
That way, you know, it's like... Third wayism, DLCism. This was, you know, as you know, invented in 1987 by Al Fromm. Basically, they were watching the disintegration of the Democratic Party in large part because the unions, labor union membership, had gone from basically a quarter of the American workforce down to around 7% of the private workforforce. There, and that was the traditional funder of the Democratic Party. So they said, okay, where can we get some money that's not the oil industry, that's not just totally toxic? Well, how about the banks? You know, so let's toss in with the banksters.
Right.
And Al Fromm brags about this in his book, how he went down to Arkansas and said to Bill Clinton, sign on to this stuff and I'll make you president and all this kind of stuff. And you know, it was like Reaganism light. And I think that people have figured out that Reaganism obviously is a scam and doesn't work. It's destroyed the middle class. And the third way policies are a semi-scam. You know, it's what we used to call Republican politics in the 60s.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And yesterday, it's real interesting, Sam. Yesterday on my program, I opened the show by saying, you know, Bernie is not going to stop, to the best of my knowledge. I mean, he's in Vermont right now, I'm sure, trying to figure out what's next. But the emails that I'm getting from the Sanders campaign are, we're going to do this based on superdelegates. We're going to try and get the superdelegates. In other words, we're going to take this to the convention. We think we can prevent, or they think they can prevent Hillary from getting the first ballot. And that's a fine strategy. And what I suggested on the air was that both Clinton and Sanders should start directing their ire against Republicans rather than each other, because they're both going to need each other's supporters when this thing is all over, and whoever is the nominee. And you know, we can begin that process now. Whether it's going to happen or not, I don't know. And what's so weird is, I said that. I wasn't saying, hey, go vote for Hillary. I was saying, if she's the nominee, I think, the Supreme Court's at stake, the Federal Election Commission's at stake, the FCC is at stake, the USDA is at stake, the FDA, all these agencies that have EPA, that have major impacts on our lives, Supreme Department Court. Of Interior, the Supreme Court, all of that stuff is at stake. And we can't have a Republican in the White House. I mean, it's just that simple. So, whoever is the nominee, we have to get behind. But right now, I think the strategy that the Sanders campaign was running up until Wisconsin, up until the day that the Clinton campaign attacked him and said he was, they were going to disqualify him or whatever the word.
Right.
And then he attacked back, and it got real personal there for a couple of days. And I really think it's time to go back to attacking Republicans. I said that, and this morning I noticed on my Twitter feed, I had all these people attacking me for saying, okay, the game is over, it's time to vote for Hillary. I never said that. I never said that.
And come on, Tom. We I think people are pretty clear. Your plan all along was to bring Bernie on your show 12 years ago to lead up to now to convince people to vote for Hillary.
Right, so we can just destroy Bernie.
No, you and I think have a very similar perspective on this. I thought that Sanders got thrown off his game when he fell into that trap about qualifications.
And he never should have,
frankly. Never should have, because his selling point has always been his issue set.
Yeah, that he's above the fray.
Yeah,
that he's the honest politician.
Yeah. And
you don't get into the mud with somebody, because, what's the old thing? You don't ever wrestle with a pig, because number one, you get dirty as hell, and number two, the pig enjoys it.
Right. Exactly. And I think it's a huge mistake. I think also, frankly, that the Clinton campaign is making a tactical blunder, too, because it's silly from their perspective.
Yes. They're hurting what could, a large chunk of what could be their voting base.
I find it. I think it was a miscalculation on both campaigns' part. And I will say that my perspective on the superdelegate thing is I want Bernie to stay in to the last minute. I have seen zero evidence that from past campaigns or from this campaign that it's actually undermining Clinton. The worst time for Hillary Clinton was when there was no campaign, essentially.
Right.
And they hadn't started the debates, and it was just the Republicans allowing them to define her, because there was no, if there's no race, nobody's going to be covering her.
Right.
There's not going to be any coverage.
Bernie has helped Hillary tremendously,
of
frankly.
Of course.
And vice versa, of course.
And I think my sense is that those voices that want Bernie out of the race want to stop him from pushing her to the left.
Right.
I mean, I think that to the extent that there is a concern about Clinton moving to the left, it is a concern that if she moves to the left and she wins, that it's sort of the myth that you can't win from those position sets gets chewed up. And I think the notion from the Sanders campaign that they're chasing superdelegates is really just, this is my analysis, that they're not really doing that. That is a way of saying we're staying in. They know that the math is much harder on the pledged delegates. I don't believe that Bernie Sanders would want to be a nominee that is lifted over the top from over pledged delegates by superdelegates. Maybe I'm wrong about that, but that's just my guess, that this is a good way of when you have to go on to these news shows and they say, what are you doing? Why are you still here? You say, the superdelegates are still out there, and that's part of, it's all part of the rules. I happen to think it's just a convenient, and I'm perfectly happy with it, excuse to stay in the race, because Jonathan Alter, for God's sakes, is telling Hillary Clinton to embrace free college.
Yeah.
I feel like I've just, I don't know,
and
I took too much Ambien. What's going on here?
Right.
And he's going to have to maybe start adopting the full-on government owns all the means of production. Because
no, it's not. It's never going to go that far.
I know, I'm saying, but
nobody's even thinking
I'm
like that.
I'm joking, but it really is extraordinary. And all right, so let me get your take on the Republican side, because I don't think we've had the opportunity to talk since.
It's been a while.
It's
if Donald Trump is the nominee, Whether it's Hillary or Bernie is on the Democratic side, they're going to. I think it's going to be a blowout election. I think he will go down the way Barry Goldwater did for very different reasons.
Yes,
but you know, on the other hand, if Ted Cruz is the nominee, I think he'll go down the way Barry Goldwater did for the same reasons.
Right,
he's too extreme to the right, and so that's
what
why
if it ends up being. I mean, you know, Paul Ryan's plan seems to be, if not Paul Ryan, then, you know, Scott Walker or somebody who had been in the race.
Or John Kasich. Yeah, I think Paul Ryan is running for president in 2020.
Right.
Right now.
And I think he made that decision only about a week ago or 2 weeks ago. I think he thought he was running this year.
I agree. But, I'm not a Republican. I'm not inside the party. I do know some Republicans, and you know, I mean, I live in D.C. You run into these people, you socialize with them, whatever. And there's a lot of concern in the party that if they pick either Cruz or Trump, that it's going to be a blowout loss, whether it's Bernie or whether it's Hillary.
Right.
So I'm just watching that one. I don't have a real strong opinion other than that I want to make sure that none of these guys get into the White House.
Right.
The big untold story right now is how extreme John Kasich is. The genuinely extremist stuff that he has done in Ohio with regard to women's rights, with regard to public education, with regard to charter schools,
Cut food stamps for people.
A whole long list.
Yeah.
And nobody is talking about that stuff because the media narrative is he's the moderate,
nice guy.
The other thing that I think that a lot of people, particularly younger people, are getting is that the media is picking our candidates. And by very carefully filtering who gets coverage and who doesn't and the nature of that coverage, they're picking our candidates. If Bernie Sanders, after he announced back in, what, March, April of last year, May, June, whenever it was, early summer, if he had gotten the kind of coverage from then until Christmas that Donald Trump got or that even, you know, Jeb Bush got.
But has anybody gotten that type of coverage, like the Donald Trump coverage?
Well, even if it was just the Jeb Bush coverage. I mean, literally 83 seconds in 6 months on ABC News, that's not coverage at all.
Right.
And you know, when you poll Democratic voters who are over 50 or over 60, who get 99% of their information from television, many of them don't even know who Bernie Sanders is, or at least didn't a few months ago. So, I think, frankly, Bernie would be way ahead had the media simply done their job, but had done their job of being news reporters.
I was going
to
say.
But instead, their job now
is to make money.
Exactly. So they are doing their job as they see it. And this is why, you know, I think that, we need to take a long, serious look at our media. And I think, frankly, it's time to bring back the...
fairness doctrine?
No, the Sherman Antitrust Act. You know, Reagan stopped enforcing that in 83, and we've seen nothing but media conglomeration ever since then. You could break up big media tomorrow. You don't need the fairness doctrine to do it. You could do it with the Sherman Act. And I think diversity of ownership in media is more important than setting rules that define media. Setting the rules that define what media can and can't do is fraught with problems, you know. But saying that we need to go back to where media was. I mean, when I started in radio in 1967, I was 16 years old in Lansing, Michigan. And I was a DJ in Country Western Station. It was the number one station in town. We had six or seven stations in Lansing. Every single one was owned by a local person. I knew these guys.
Right.
Now there's not a single one that's locally owned, to the best of my knowledge. They're all owned by chains. They're all, you know, half of them don't even have staff anymore.
Right.
It's like, you know, our farm team for radio has evaporated by and large, and the diversity in programming that used to exist no longer exists because two companies own well over 90% of the radio stations. Three companies own or functionally control virtually all the television stations. And then you've got a handful of companies that own most of the newspapers in the United States.
But how do you, I mean...
You could break that up with using the Sherman Act tomorrow.
But how would that, I mean, I guess... I mean, how would that translate to things like cable television, broadcast television, and media outlets that come via the web? I mean, you know, I mean, it's extremely complicated. I'm all for it, and you know, really, the dynamic is in my mind is best encapsulated by the notion of like what a news division was expected to earn
25 years ago for a network. It was basically a break even, if not a losing proposition for the network. It was simply a way in which they built trust with the American public. And, you know, who's the boss was supposed to make the money for the network.
Right.
And now the news division is required to make the same amount of money as, you know, Big Bang Theory.
Yeah.
Not quite Big Bang Theory. Exactly. But and that's very problematic.
And
that because, look, you and I both know that when they put Donald Trump on, they know by 4 p.m. the next day whether that helped their ratings or hurt. And
right.
if the ratings went up.
And thus the bottom line.
Yeah. And they could put Bernie Sanders on, or they could put Hillary Clinton on, or Jeb Bush.
Well, here's the problem. Because, you know, using that logic, had they really started focusing on Bernie a year and a half ago, or a year ago when he announced, a little more than a year ago, I think, it would have enhanced their ratings. It would have made them more money because they could have had a horse race on the Democratic side, too, which is what they want. The problem is that Bernie is calling to get money out of politics. There's going to be $5 billion right. spent in this election cycle. $4.5 billion of that is going to go right to the television networks.
Yes.
And that's why you're never. That's why they cut away from him whenever he starts talking about money in politics. They can't afford that. Their entire
that's what
business
I think people don't understand
relies on
that,
this.
That I think fully one-third of the revenue, the biggest source of revenue for local stations, many of which are owned by the networks, is politics.
Right.
On any given cycle.
Right.
And that's an extraordinary amount of money.
Yeah.
I mean, that's really hugely problematic. All right, well, so give me your sense. I mean, I tend to think that they don't necessarily have their the hands on the levers in terms of the Republicans.
Who's the they?
The Republicans. Uh-huh. Like, I don't think there is a they anymore. I think they're too disparate to be a...
Well, Rince Priebus has been a total incompetent.
A total incompetent, but it's also there's so much money on the right that you have these competing incentives. I mean, you know, I think... It came out yesterday, and I've been saying this since day one. Like, one of the Breitbart editors has been consulting for the Trump campaign.
What a surprise.
Well, come on. We know what that is.
And Drudge has been plugging it.
Right. I mean, we know what this is. They're getting paid for coverage. I mean,
well,
that's it, period.
And the other thing that most people don't realize is that the Koch network, is
three
now...
three times bigger than the Republican Party.
That's right. In terms of employees,
yeah.
In terms of people on the ground, in terms of money spent. It's like there's an entire political party that nobody talks about and that seems to be invisible. And it's more powerful than either the Republican or Democratic Party. And it's flipping our political system. And there's no discussion about
it because all
of their money is going to end up on the television networks.
Right. No discussion of it. I mean, it's stunning. And then...
And that's oligarchy,
by the way. And then you have like multiple other sources of revenue for these people, and they're all following their own agenda, and so it's pulling apart the Republican Party, because the thing that they have relied on, I think, is sort of like, we're unified, right? Like, we do function surgically,
right?
And so I mean I would imagine the calculation is with Trump we lose, with Cruz we lose. Probably with Kasich, they lose, too. I think they've got to realize
because... Although the polls show Kasich beating Clinton, but the negative oppo on Kasich has not begun yet.
Yes, and frankly, what it would involve to get Kasich to be the nominee at this point would be, I think, incredibly destructive to the Republican Party. I mean, so they're looking at three really bad options. It's just a question of, I think, to the extent that they have any ability to influence the outcome, it's just which one continues putting money in their pocket. Who doesn't get kicked out of a job?
I'm hearing in D.C. that the fallback guy that they want to go to is Rubio, but I think that's crazy.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
The guy can't win his own state.
No. I mean, it's absurd. It's absurd. And what kind of campaign, when you have not, like, to go from no infrastructure on July 30th, to a national campaign, you can't do that in two or
three months. Can if you've got the Koch network behind you. The thing, the challenge that the Republican Party has, the big problem that the Republican Party has right now, is that they've been running a scam on America since the 1980s, arguably since the Nixon administration, but in a big way and in a very systematic way and a very intentional way since the 1980s. You go back to Paul Weyrich in 1981.
Right.
Running the Reagan campaign or helping run it and talking about how we need to suppress voting. You know, they've been doing that now for 35 years. It's now on steroids. You get 33 states with these voter suppression laws. But the biggest con is that they have been responsible for the transfer of somewhere between $3 and $7 trillion worth of wealth from the middle class to the top 0.01% over the last two decades. It's a massive transfer of wealth, and Donald and the politicians are all wholly owned, particularly by the fossil fuel industry and the Koch brothers. Donald Trump came out and said this out loud, a Republican. It wasn't a Democrat, so they couldn't just dismiss it, couldn't laugh at it, they couldn't ignore it. And the quote, Tea Party grassroots, the well-intentioned people who got into this, low-information voters who have been brought in by the Koch brothers, you know, propaganda, they're listening to Trump going, oh, this makes a lot of sense.
Right.
And Trump and Bernie are the only two people who are talking about this in a really consequential way. Again, if Hillary could reinvent herself as Bernie, she could take that mantle and she could be pulling people out of the Republican Party. Bernie will. I know that because, you know, having lived in Vermont for a decade, you drive around Vermont. I remember the 2000 election, I guess it was. Louise and I were driving around the Northeast Kingdom, the most conservative part of the state. It's very poor. It's very rural. And you see these signs, you know, George Bush for president, Bernie for Congress in the
right,
same front yard
right.
over and over and over again, everywhere. Because even the Republicans in Vermont get it that Bernie, they may not agree with his policies, or at least all of his policies, but they get it that he's an honest politician.
Right.
Which is, historically
an oxymoron.
The story
he's telling of where we are is accurate to them.
Yes.
And they're attracted to that. You know, let's travel in time to this time next year for a moment. And either Clinton or Sanders has won. And the Republicans have lost either control of the Senate or at least three or four seats in the Senate. The Republicans have lost 20 seats in the House. They still retain control, but with a very slim majority.
Right.
So all the people who have lost their seats, who are Republicans, were closest to the center on that right spectrum, right? It's like the senator from New Hampshire, the senator from Wisconsin,
right.
Places that are like purpley,
right.
Bluishy states. The Republicans who have lost in the House came from districts that were like R+2 on the partisan index, or maybe
right.
D+1, you know, like places that maybe Obama had won
right.
in 2008, and these guys have been in there. So the Republicans who remain statistically become the more virulent right-wingers, right? The Freedom Caucus still going to be 40 person strong, maybe 45, you know, after this election.
Well, if the Koch brothers have anything to say about it.
But the majority of Republicans is now, instead of it being 240, it's closer to like 222 or something.
Right.
This is just going to get worse, right? Like this level of they're just going to go. They're just in this death spiral. I mean, sadly, they also control a lot of states. But as a national party, or as an ability sort of like to, you know, snap out of it, as President Obama keeps saying, they're losing the ability to do that. Like, where does this go?
I think if you look at the history of the United States, and this was kind of the core first third of my book, The Crash of 2016. If you look at the history of the United States, you see that radical change, really genuinely radical change, happens about every 80 years in the United States. And there's a brilliant book called The Fourth Turning it'll come to me. Anyhow, it's called The Fourth Turning. Strauss and Howe. And they suggest that, you know, Toynbee said, when the man who remembers the horrors of the last Great War dies, the next Great War becomes inevitable, which is about 80 years. And they identified these four generations that continuously recycle. And so you've got, like, coming out of the Great Depression and World War II.
Yeah, it's funny. I just had this conversation with my 10-year-old daughter. Because I was like, you are... They did in her classroom, they did...
Right.
They're studying the 20s.
Yeah.
They did the stock market crash.
Right.
And, like,
right.
4 days ago, she had $11,000. Yesterday, she was in the hole $1,000.
Right.
And I'm like, you know, my dad told me about it because his mom lived through it.
Right.
But you are just like,
yeah,
it's gone now.
Yeah. So what happens is you get one generation that goes through depression and war, and they become the, you know, and then they give birth to a generation, my father's generation, that that are the quiet builders, you know, the strong, silent builders. They give birth to a generation that says, well, that didn't get us anywhere. You know, we're going to find out the meaning of life. And they go off in spiritual quest and sometimes political quest. And then they give birth to a generation, and now we're to generation kind of X and millennial. They give birth to a generation that says, you know, our parents went after a spiritual quest. They didn't find enlightenment. Our grandparents tried to build the country. They didn't, you know, it helped a little bit. But now it's like, screw all that. I want to get rich. And that generation then, and this is not the Gen Xers right now. I think it's more of the Gen Ys, but or not the millennials, rather. But that generation then screws things up out of greed and crashes the economy, which starts the cycle all over again.
Wait, so you're saying the Gen Xers are doing this?
No, it's no, well, Tom. Yeah, I would say the people in their 30s, 40s, and 50s, by and large, who are largely disengaged from the political process, they're not showing up. It's mostly millennials and boomers, are, you know, busy making money. It's not a bad thing. It's just what's so. And in this economy, it's also security. And in a country with a lousy safety net like ours,
right,
it's you know, saving your life kind of thing and your families. But the point is that every 80 years you have a crisis. 80 years ago is the Great Depression of World War II. 80 years before that, it was the Great Crash of 1857 and the Civil War. 80 years before that, it was the Great Crash of 1770, followed by the American Revolution. You can take this in Strauss and Howe's book, The Fourth Turning. They take this back to the 1400s. And so this is a long way of answering your initial question, is when are we going to see this big change? I think we're going to see this big change when the economy really and truly collapses. And, you know, with this report that we just got about all five of the big banks are worse than they were in 2008, and they're bigger, by the
right.
way, and all this high-frequency trading stuff on Wall Street that Bernie wants to, you know, slightly tax, which will basically put the high-frequency traders out of business, but they're the danger to the system. You know, bringing back Glass-Steagall. If that stuff doesn't happen, there is going to be a really serious economic crash, and that's the point, I think, at which the entire country gets mobilized. And we either have a progressive revolution like we did in 1933, or we have a fascist revolution like Spain, Italy, and Germany did in 1933 in response to the exact same depression.
Right.
And you know, Roosevelt was very clear. He was going to save capitalism from itself. He wasn't going to go communist, obviously, and he wasn't going to go fascist. But those two factions were very real and very visible in the early 30s. And very powerful, frankly.
Yeah, I think it's people tend to forget that.
Right.
And people tend to forget it was a march on Washington that was going to be a coup, essentially, an armed coup.
Oh, yeah, with Smedley Butler, you know, had been hired to lead the thing, and yeah. He blew the whistle on them. But they had 500,000 men, you know, under arms who were going to march into the White House and drag FDR out of gunpoint. I mean, literally. And FDR shut down the congressional investigation into it because he didn't want anybody else to get the idea. You know?
Right.
But it's like, you know... And I think that right now that movement we're seeing, you know, in the Occupy movement and in the Tea Party movement, it's people are saying things are screwed up. We got to fix it. So let's see where it goes.
Well, Tom, always a pleasure. This is probably you showing up have probably exhausted all the luck I'm going to have in Vegas.
Oh.
So. I am anticipating having some real problems at the table.
Yeah, I'm sorry for the bad blackjack advice.
Well, that's all right. I'm still slowly recovering from that.
Yeah.
Tom Hartman, always a pleasure.
It's great to see you, Sam.
Thank you
so
much. All right, ladies and gentlemen, that was a lot of great luck. And like I say, I anticipate now losing tremendously at the tables because of it. So that's just the way that it goes, I guess. For me. In Las Vegas. All right. Well, let's take a quick break, and we'll head into the... Oh, my God. It's already... Let's see. Maybe I'll take a phone call. I don't, you know, my IM, I just can't get going. All of my iPads are from like 1982, I think. And they've all bricked on me. So having a little problems with actually like getting an IM system up. But I am able to play music to head into the fun half. I'll try and take a couple of phone calls.
there's a couple of stories that maybe we'll talk about. Two Michigan State employees have been charged in the poisoning of Flint's water. I imagine by now. I mean, I can't tell you how happy I am about this. A buddy of mine, like 5-6 years ago, was like, we got to get Andrew Jackson off the $20 bill. Like, nobody's talking about that. And to have Andrew Jackson, I know he's going to be on the backside in a small portion of it, but I mean, his legacy. And yes, I get the fact that he was a populist, but his legacy of slaughtering Native Americans, pretty disturbing to celebrate a guy like that. And so it's very exciting to see Harriet Tubman on end up on the $20 bill. That is, if you ever needed proof, positive, that President Obama is the Manchurian candidate, there's nothing that socialist Kenyans have been agitating for more than Harriet Tubman on the bill. I mean, he is totally cuckolded by, I mean, it's quite clear. And A.G. Schneiderman is looking into the voting issues in Brooklyn. Cliff and I mentioned yesterday that about 130,000 people were prevented from voting, shouldn't have been prevented from voting, on top of the ridiculousness of having to register for a party 9 months out before an election. I mean, it's just absurd. And someone had emailed me and asked, or I guess maybe tweeted at me, and said, how can you be for closed party elections but also think that it's okay to change your registration like a week in advance? And I just don't think there should be a big bar to voting. I mean, on some level, you may want it not to be complete whimsy, but I don't think there's anything so sacrosanct that a week out isn't sufficient of a bar, as it were. I guess maybe we won't be doing a fun half today. Maybe we'll just do a freebie. Not seeming to get any calls, so maybe what we'll do is we'll wrap it up and save this good stuff for tomorrow. 90 minutes. That was a pretty good one, folks. That's what we're going to do. I'm going to wrap it up. And tomorrow on the program, more lawyers, more stories of corporate misfeasance, malfeasance, and other types of feasance. And then, I don't know, maybe more surprise guests. Oh, wait, we got a phone call. Maybe we should try. Let me see if I can take this phone call. See if this works. I'm just really sort of curious if this is going to work. I'm not sure if it will, but let's see. Is this going to work? You calling from a 423 area code. Who's this?
Hey, Josh in Tennessee.
It's Josh from where?
Tennessee.
So, from Tennessee. All right, welcome to the program, Josh.
All right. Said nobody was calling me, so I thought I'd call you. I felt bad for you.
Oh, is that it? Well, I appreciate your calling in to try the technology. Sounds pretty good, I think, yeah. Right?
So I guess I'll ask you a question.
All right. Let me hear it.
If Hillary wins the nomination, there's a lot of people that are want to know where to channel this, the energy that's behind Bernie, and I think that's had a lot to do with the you know what movement.
Right.
People feel like they're just kind of being made to get in line to the same corrupt, or corrupt may be a strong word, but system that they're fighting against.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the tasks that Bernie's going to have is going to be able to sort of to provide that channel, whether that's in the form of support this slate of congressional candidates. He's been using his email list to support like three or four. Zephyr Teach out one of them. But also, I think, you know, different issue sets. And, you know, at the end of the day, it seems to me that, you know, one guy tweeted at me, I mean, just, and I understand this is a small group of people, so don't misinterpret what I'm saying here, but somebody emailed me and was like, I'm not ever going to register as a Democrat, even to vote for Bernie, and I'm not going to vote in the, I would have voted for Bernie in the general. And, you know, like, that type of attitude is like what a child says. I mean, the bottom line is if you want something, if you want a specific output or goal or outcome, I should say, then you figure out the best way of pursuing it. And the most likely way of pursuing it that will get you that outcome. Now, it's possible that, you know, and we're seeing already, I mean, if you've got Jonathan Alter just calling for Hillary Clinton to embrace free college, not debt-free college, but free college, it is quite possible she gets into office and says, screw this, I'm not really going to work for it. I mean, certainly, you know, there's plenty of examples that with the Obama administration that I could point to where that same dynamic occurred. The bankruptcy cram-down bill was sort of one of the most prominent ones in the first couple of years. But the fact is that as slowly as it is, you're pushing the ball forward to a certain outcome. And no, I don't think that Hillary Clinton is going to necessarily surprise us with being a secret lefty who's going to come in and put in this agenda. But there has to be outlets where this energy is channeled that shows at least some progress with pushing specific issue issues and a set and an agenda. And so, I mean, hopefully we'll see that. And hopefully, you know, we'll see people get involved in local politics and, you know, continue to sort of like to push to control more of the apparatus that exists. So, I mean, that's my best answer. I don't know if that's, you know.
Yeah, that's kind of how I've been looking at it. It's put my efforts doing what I can to best push, you know, Hillary if she is the president to the left, and you know, to force her to respond to issues that we care about.
Yeah, and I think, like, look, you know, if you start, you know, with some of the potential senators out there, right? Like, you know, Kamala Harris in California, let's say, or you know, Feingold in Wisconsin, and
it's just tough for me here in rural Tennessee with Scott Dejarlane as my representative.
Yeah, no, it must stink. And
you're not going to be electing any socialists here in Bradley County.
No, you're not. And you know, you're deep in the woods, buddy. Maybe literally, but also figuratively. And so, you know, I hope at least the weather's good.
I appreciate your show. You know, so I'm not completely alone out here.
Well, I'm glad we could keep you company. Good luck with it. Thanks for calling in.
All right. No problem. Thank you.
Bye-bye. All right, let's take one more phone call. Calling from a 204 area code. Who's this?
Yeah, hi. It's Dan in Winnipeg. Long time listener, first time caller.
Hello, Dan. I'm sorry I can't give you a fanfare.
No, that's fine.
I can give you this, though.
I was listening to Air America right back to the beginning with Al Franken. And just, here's a thought for, I guess, would it be possible at all to get Al Franken on to maybe have a debate of some sort with you being the pro-Bernie and him being for Hillary? Maybe you could convince him as a super delegate to change his mind. And also there's rumors of him being a possible vice president candidate. And just to have him on, if that be possible at all.
I periodically put requests in for Al, and I interviewed him, I don't know now, maybe 4 years ago in Minnesota. He only recently started doing more national press. I'll give it a try. I mean, I periodically put in a request, and we'll see. I don't think I'll be able to convince him to change his allegiance, but... it would definitely be a worthwhile opportunity to have him on. But
here's another thought. You haven't had him on in quite some time, and I don't know. I'd be kind of disappointed when I'm reading the Daily Cause and Cause being so much being pro-Hillary and so much, I don't know. I just don't like how, I'd be disappointed for his sort of attitude lately. So I'd maybe that'd be another possibility for a guest sometime.
Yeah, Marcos, I haven't talked to him in a long time, actually. But I think, he has always been very strongly partisan. And I don't know, who knows what, what's in someone's, sort of personal mindset. But I think in the context of where he fits in politically, I think that he thinks it's most efficient to be very partisan. And from a partisan perspective, he's done the numbers and is convinced that Hillary's the nominee and then wants to move forward from there. And, he pulled the trigger earlier than I would have. And I certainly want Bernie to stay in. And really, I've yet to see any evidence that there's any reason to believe that he's going to hurt Hillary's chances in the general. I just don't buy it. And I'm not sure what kind of attacks would hurt Hillary for the general to come out of the primary. But there's not, is Ted Cruz, who's gotten a loan from Goldman Sachs where his wife worked, is he going to be able to run that he's the anti-Wall Street candidate? Is Donald Trump? I mean, I just don't see it. That's my perspective on it, but.
Yeah, and I'll just say I miss the Break Room Live chat room. YouTube's just not the same thing.
Yeah. Well, a lot of things I miss from those days, buddy. Appreciate the phone call.
All right, good talking to you, Sam. Thanks for taking the call.
Bye-bye. Winnipeg in the house, ladies and gentlemen. Very strong presence in Winnipeg. All right, let's take one more call. Colin from a 212 area code. Who's this?
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Hi, Sam.
Yes.
This is Brayers in Manhattan.
Who's it, Brayers?
Brayers.
Okay. Hey, Brayers.
I also felt sorry for you, so I called. I do have a legitimate question.
It's going to get worse after I hit the tables.
If you were aware of, I think you were aware of Democracy Spring and Democracy Awakening. I wasn't listening 100% of the time when you were on air. But if you were aware of those two movements and what you think of them and how everything proceeded.
I mean, I had mentioned that Cenk and Adam Green, I had trouble, frankly, finding a lot about it. It got virtually no coverage. I saw like TYT, there was more coverage of Cenk at the airport than there was on some level of the arrests. I didn't, you know, it crept up on me. I mean, I saw Ari Berman's talk at Democracy Awakening. There are times where I just am sort of somehow not plugged into certain things, to be honest with you. And this is one of them. I mean, like, you know, I've interviewed a number of people who were there over the years. Sandra Steingraber was there, and I think I've interviewed Reverend Barber on Ring of Fire. But I just, I did not have a large awareness of it. You know, there are some of these things that I just don't hear about for whatever reason. And so I don't have a sense of how much it resonated. You know,
right.
You know, like I say, I watched Ari Berman's stuff there, and Ari is one of the country's, you know, at this point, foremost, I think, experts on voter suppression on a national level. I mean, he's been
right.
He's dedicated the past 4 or 5 years to this. I don't have a sense of like who was listening. You know what I mean?
Right. So my follow-up question, and I appreciate your candor, is this, which is, if you have a concept yourself or an idea yourself of what people should do under present circumstances, because it seems that what Democracy Spring and Democracy Awakening represent are an old format, which is as honorable and decent and striving as these groups were and are. They follow a basic format, it seemed to me, which is that you march and protest. And there was a comment in Dissent magazine. David Bell, the historian David Bell, was interviewed in Dissent about the French Revolution, and he said about social movements in general and about the concept of a revolution in general, quote, what are they going to do besides stand out there and yell? And I thought, well, that's a rather snide comment, but it's also sort of true. So in what form should a response to the present crisis take, is my question.
I mean, you know, look, I think you got to look at like the models of things that have become that have been successful. And we have some examples of that. For me, you know, I think the marriage equality is one. But I think in some ways, you know, there's a different dynamic that was going on with marriage equality than, say, let's say the fight for 15. Right. I mean, like the 15, the idea that there was going to be a $15 minimum wage anywhere 4 years ago, okay, when we had those first strikes, small strikes, I mean, handful of people at fast food restaurants, was pretty far-fetched. But I think that you can get a sense, and, you know, the unions were sort of helping on that, and you had, and Cliff mentioned the other day, you know, like out in Seattle, Nick Hanauer. I mean, a series of very small victories can aggregate. And, you know, now we have two of the four biggest states in the country are en route to a $15 minimum wage. And mm-hmm. We just had the... now the two leading candidates, or the two candidates in the Democratic primary, obviously Bernie's been there for a while, but Clinton, as far as I'm concerned, moved over the course of 8 months. You know, when she says, if it hits my desk, I'm going to sign it. I mean, as opposed to what? You know, that's the argument. And I mean, I think that there is sort of some lessons there in terms of organization and about that gap that that social media and the internet can play in aggregating disparate things that happen around the country, right? I mean, like, you know, on the biggest of days, maybe it was, I don't know if it was a Black Friday strike or what, but you're talking probably less than, 1,500 people. Maybe it was 2,000, maybe it was 3,000, but you're not talking tens of thousands of people. But it just had a big media narrative. And then when you see one city...
But almost by accident. I mean, it just seems so... it's so mercurial. And I want to say, just quickly in response to your example, I think the core philosophy, at least as I understood it, of Democracy Spring was we're all in our silos with our different needs and our different agendas. We're fighting for the environment, or we're fighting for our kids' school, or whatever it may be. And as I understood the philosophy of Democracy Spring, they said, listen, we've identified the core problem, and the core problem is money in politics. It's the fact that corporations have been given personhood and speech. And end that, and we can solve all these other problems. So I wonder if your example isn't just a happy accident. And I'm not trying to advocate for one position or another. I'm just interested in your opinion on what... So it sounds to me like what you're saying is pick your issue and stick with it.
Well, I'm just talking about the process. I mean, look... I think, everybody likes to say, not everybody, but there's a lot of, like, the core problem is. You know what I mean? And that tends to be, and maybe I'm just more sensitive to it because I get emails all the time saying, like, your problem is that you're not discussing what I think is the core problem. And,
right.
I think that you got to get a little bit more tangible than that. Like, look, if you believe that Citizen United is the key issue, and I think that's too narrow, frankly, then really what you're talking about is, and I know people are going to get annoyed at me saying this, you got to elect a Democrat to get that fifth Supreme Court justice. And really, it's going to get quicker if it's six. I mean, that's just the bottom line. I mean, this is, there's no other route from there, from here to there. And, I've yet to sit down with Cenk and talk about things like Wolfpack. But I have some real reservations about the efficacy of constitutional conventions. I mean, I've read a bunch of different things, disparate things. Some people tell me I'm wrong. Some people say that I'm right. But I think that's a Pandora's box that I'm not sure how much you can control, frankly, once that's open. And in situations like that, I tend to think that big money is going to have more control than not big money. But I don't know. But I know that from, the calculation of the Supreme Court is pretty straightforward.
Right.
And, I think I think that there's a trend. And I think all of these things become a little bit self-perpetuating, but I don't know. My answers end at one point.
Very discouraging if the trend results in her Royal Clinton taking the White House. I just
but that's not where it ends. I mean, that's the point. Is that like it transcends and runs in parallel to electoral politics. She's just a person who's surrounded by other people who are responding to a series and sets of incentives and who has to deal with members of Congress. And she's never, in my mind, necessarily embraced an issue set that I particularly care for, but I'm very encouraged that there seems to be an ability to push her. I think that's good.
Well, Sam, you're tremendously more optimistic than I am, and I think on that note, given where you are, you should hit the table.
Well, then I may have a very distinctly different tone tomorrow, but I appreciate the phone call.
All right.
All right, bye-bye.
All right, well, thank you, and your show is tremendous. We listen to it every day.
Oh, well, thanks. I appreciate that. All right, one more.
Thank you.
One more call, and then I'll go, and it'll be a freebie Thursday. Calling from a 510 area code. Got to turn your radio down.
Hey there, this is Mitch from Oakland. First time, long time.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, a bunch of stuff.
Pretty good, what's up?
I was just calling because I was listening to the Benjamin Dixon show a couple days ago, or rather, I guess he was filling in for another show, and he was talking about the crossover of money between the Hillary Victory Fund and HFA. So I can't remember exactly the specifics, but I think that it was something along the lines of the Victory Fund being a super PAC that was collecting large donor donations, and it was expressly with the purpose of funding, you know, state and local Democrats in addition to the Hillary campaign. So it was expected that, you know, the maximum of $2,700 per donor would have gone from the funds towards the campaign directly. But over the last couple of quarters, it's gone somewhere in like the 40% if you count the advertising that's gone specifically for the Hillary campaign, as well as paying staffers that were working on it before it was dispersed to the state and local parties. And I was wondering if you knew anything about that, or if it was just kind of, I was just wondering if you knew anything along those lines.
You know, this is, I think, was the basis of, I think, a lawsuit that the Sanders campaign is filing, or I should say they filed a complaint with the Federal Elections Commission. I mean, I don't know the details of it. None of that stuff surprises me. I think the chances of the Federal Election Commission doing anything is probably somewhere around nil. They're completely feckless organization. I think they said a year and a half ago, they said, like, we might as well close down because the laws are so obtuse and we don't have the mechanism to enforce them. I think that, like, literally...
Well, also in the fact that there's a 3-3 split on the FEC commission, and it's just like a 4-4 on the Supreme Court, right?
Right. And so, I mean... You know, I don't know what to tell you beyond that. I mean, I think from a narrative perspective, I'm not terribly surprised by it.
Yeah, that's fair enough. I just wondered if you had any more information on that. But anyway, I'm a pretty strong Bernie supporter, but I've definitely come down on your side. You know, giving up the chance, you know, Bernie or Buster or whatever, to fill another, you know, 1, 2, 3 Supreme Court seats and take a control of another branch, you know, 1 of 3 branches of government for the next 10, 15, 20 years is a crazy opportunity to pass up, even if you do want to do some kind of protest vote.
Yeah. I agree.
I also thought it was kind of interesting what your caller was talking about with, you know, different movements and whether you want to focus on staying siloed or kind of overlapping, intersectional. I have no idea where I come down on that, but I definitely think that there's a role for both inside-outside movements in terms of actually getting politics to change.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think, you know, people getting involved in some active way, one way or another, I think is end up being a net positive. I just don't think that there's, you know, you never necessarily know that one way or another is going to be more effective than another. And sometimes it's just getting some momentum.
I appreciate the phone call.
Absolutely. All right. Have a good one.
You too. All right, folks. Boom, boom. Ladies and gentlemen, I'll be back tomorrow at noon Eastern time with more Majority Report. And now I will say goodbye as soon, excuse me, as I find the outro music. Here it is. Bye-bye.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in. My pilot light shining bright. I get somewhere the choice is made, for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I get somewhere I lost my drive. Shifted in and out of gear.